from WCVB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 Podcast. Today's guest, one of our all-time favorite guests, the man, the myth, the legend, Mike Lynch joins us. He breaks down all things Boston sports. Lynch, he tells us whether the Celtics can reclaim their contender status after a rough stretch. He's not very optimistic about the Red Sox, and he jumps in the Wayback Machine to tell us the last time he remembers there being this much apathy in Red Sox Nation surrounding the team. And also, there's nobody who is more respected by Bill Belichick from a media standpoint than Mike Lynch. He always has a great feel for the way Belichick operates, the way he thinks. So you're going to want to hear who Lynchy thinks the best quarterback option is in 2021. And also, one Ellen Fleming and Mike Lynch, they rekindle their mutual admiration for each other. Lynchy always reminding me that Ellen is actually the star of this podcast. However, there's a little bit of an age gap between them, and that means there's a pop culture reference gap that comes into play on this podcast as Lynchy references Animal House and Johnny Carson and Johnny Carson's sidekick, one Ed McMahon, who really, I mean, Ellen Fleming has no idea. I mean, he could have been talking about Ed Burns for all Ellen knew. She had no idea. So these pop culture references just went right over your head.
I mean, I could tell that it was a compliment when he said, I'm like the Ed McMahon to this Johnny Carson show. I knew that was that definitely sounded like a good thing.
Context clues.
Yes, the context clues behind it. And I love when Mike Lynch is here because we're very similar.
You guys are.
And we have a very similar way of looking at things, but just in completely different generations.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, so like your generation, the way you look at things, the Kardashians are must-see TV. Lynchy said that when his daughters watch the Kardashians, he tells them, basically, you might as well put your brain in a frying pan.
You know, I don't believe that because my dad has said similar things, and he mentioned it like he'll walk by while they're watching.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, this is, you know, this is going to fry your brain. But they stay watching. Okay. And I guarantee you, Mike Lynch has stayed and watched.
Well, I know you've been watching a lot lately, and it's tough for you because this whole like Kanye West, Kim Kardashian breakup, this is kind of like the Brady Belichick breakup for you.
This is just like the Brady Belichick breakup for me, in which one is definitely going to end up doing better than the other. And at the end of the day, I think Kanye is going to be like Bill Belichick and thinking he could have done better, but he can't.
Oof, yeah, we could see that. Yeah, that's really interesting. Both guys that have a lot of confidence in themselves. And just with the pop culture references, I mean, you've sort of experienced this. You've been on the other end where you're making pop culture references mm-hmm. that the younger generation doesn't get.
Yes, at the ripe age of 28 years old, I am.
Oh, I thought you were 29.
No, I'm 28. And for everyone, I believe our next birthdays should not count because of COVID. So I'll be turning 28 again in May. I have realized recently, like, I'm old on the internet because Gen Zers are coming for the young millennials, and it doesn't feel good. The internet used to be a safe space, and it is no longer a good space.
Interesting. Yeah, you've sort of experienced it. Well, I'll say this. Mike Lynch, he's a classic. He's timeless. He never goes out of style. He's always contemporary, and he's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
Now, as promised, we're joined by the one and only, the legend himself, Mike Lynch. Mike, how are you today? And Mike, you're on the mend.
I am. I had a hip replacement 3 weeks ago today. We're taping this on March 1. I had it February 8. It's gone great so far. I'm a little bit impatient, but hopefully I'll add 30 yards to my tee ball this summer.
Oh, that's important. You look great. I was joking with you before the show. You look really good. I think you're going to be back before Chris Sale returns for the Red Sox.
How many innings has he pitched since that 300 strikeout season?
Oh,
I mean, maybe what, two starts, I think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been rough. So we'll get to that. I want to start here with the Boston Celtics. They're now back to 500 after they pulled out, really, miraculous gets overused, but really an unexpected win, I would say, 111-110 over the Washington Wizards on Sunday. They were down 5 points with 46 seconds to go and managed to come back, riding Jason Tatum, who made three really, really clutch layups down the stretch here. But before this stretch of the back-to-back wins, and it's the first time they've won back-to-back games, Lynchy, since January 24th and January 25th. They went a month without winning two consecutive games. They had lost 8 of 11 before that. What do you make of this Celtics team, and what do you think has been ailing it?
Well, one of the problems is that there's so many games compacted into each week. There's not a lot of time for practice. They can have film sessions, you know, in the hotel, whatever, but there's not a lot of time for practice. And it's hard when you go on the road, you've got to practice in the same facility where you play the games. And they might not be ready. It could be a hockey team playing there that particular night. So that's number one. Number two, Marcus Smart. I think I counted two or three games that Smart, Tatum.
It's two games.
Is it two?
Are you talking about the core four guys?
Yeah.
Yes. If you're talking about Smart, Kemba, and, you know, JT and JB, they played a total of two games together in 28 minutes.
All right. So there's, I mean, that tells you an awful lot. And you can say what you want about Marcus Smart every time he takes a shot in crunch time. You go, no, what is he doing? But he's on the floor. And he has been on the floor the last 3 or 4 years during crunch time, a favorite of Brad Stevens. And I always wondered why he was on the floor, because I didn't think he could throw the ball in the ocean. You know? on Lynn Beach Boulevard from Red Rock.
I love it.
but he's good, and he's the guy you want on the floor. And, you know, he's in street clothes. He's getting technical fouls, you know.
Yeah, well, he's engaged, which is good.
Yeah.
You know, he's engaged in terms of the games. So that's a good point. They certainly missed Smart during the stretch where they were struggling. You go back to, it would have been nice to have Marcus Smart on Luka Doncic when Luka hit those two shots, when they blew the 24-point lead against New Orleans on February 21st. But here's the thing about that. Before Smart got hurt, they had lost 5 of 7 games with Smart. So I agree with you. I do think there's something to the idea they haven't had the core four guys together. I think that would be huge. What's encouraged me the most this stretch recently, how about Kemba Walker? Because I think he's so huge to them. I think he's the difference between this being a team that I said this before, Lynchy. If the Celtics were a sitcom, there'd be 2.5 men. You know, it'd be Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and Kemba, who, like yourself, is sort of on the mend, on the comeback trail. But the way he's played the last three games combined, he has scored 74 points and looked really, really good. If he's going to play like that, Kemba, then suddenly they have three all-stars. Yeah. I actually think Kemba is the key to the season.
He's the fulcrum of this Celtics team. And I'm going to say offense and defense. He made a great jump switch last night with Celtics were about to let this thing slip away from them. He made a great jump switch after Tatum had just scored a basket, and he just sprung somebody loose for a hoop as well. So he's playing some pretty good defense. He also has got a real good thing going with Tice. You know, the two of them, Tice just is the happiest guy in the world to see Kemba Walker, because every time he sets a pick for him, Kemba just, you know, draws the double team and throws a little bounce pass. And Tice loves that mid-range jump shot. And, you know, I'm always fighting with myself internally saying, should Robert Williams be getting more airtime, playing time than Daniel Tice? But I see when Tice shoots, I said, well, they got enough offense out there on the floor. I said, why not bring Williams in as sort of a little bit of a intimidator in the middle in the paint? I mean, if Williams played more last night, would Beal have scored 46 points? I mean, Beal's nobody stopped.
Nobody can stop Beal. He leads the league in scoring points per game.
And you know the only thing that stopped Beal last night, and I'm going to give a big props to Brad Stevens for this, when he went to the 2-3 zone.
Okay.
That was huge. Because when they were in that man-to-man, once he beat his guy, you know, Pritchard tried to cover him one time, and it was almost embarrassing. And he just goes to the hole, uncontested, unmolested. And you're going to get somebody in there that's going to say, hey, you want to come in here, either one, you're going to score, number two, you're going to get fouled, and number three, I'm going to hit you so hard, you're going to think three times before you come down this lane with so much confidence next time.
Yeah, they could have used Perk. That's what Perk used to do.
Perk is great doing that. Yeah, Perk was great.
But you're absolutely right about that. And it's funny you mentioned Tice, Lynchy, because he's been so good. And when they brought in Tristan Thompson, people were saying, okay, Tristan Thompson's the new guy that's going to be part of the crunch time lineup. And I remember saying, no, I think it's still Tice. And I still think Tice is their best big. When you look at it, just the fact he can space the floor, he hit a big three the other night against Indiana. He's a guy that can make those mid-range jumpers that you're talking about. He's a very good rim protector, not as good as Williams, but certainly better than Tristan Thompson. So the Celtics have some pieces here. I guess the question is sort of, is there enough help here around Tatum and Brown for them to be a legitimate contender in the East?
I don't think there is. Okay. You're probably alluding to the same graphic I saw, 26th in scoring, the Celtics bench.
Yeah.
And that's not good. I mean, you got to have, you know, bench scoring a lot of times it tips the scales in a particular game. I think they need more production out of the bench. I don't know if that means Brad plays these guys a little more, but again, here we go, practice. And I sound like Allen Iverson. You know, practice, practice, practice.
We're talking about practice.
We're talking about practice here. I don't have confidence in their bench. And, you know, there are some guys on there. There's some veteran guys that have been around the league a little bit. And
Jeff Teague.
Yeah, Teague. He's a guy. But right now, is the school jury still out on him? Or are you is it an incomplete grade for him so far?
I mean, for me, I think he's been a disappointment.
Yeah.
Okay. He's played better the last two games, but he had a lot of DNP CDs, not play, coach's decision. He seems to be out of the doghouse and back in the rotation, but he's disappointed. I thought Tristan Thompson has honestly been underwhelming for what they paid him in terms of the full mid-level and being hard-capped. You know, I think that still, to me, the most exciting thing about Tristan Thompson has been he's married to a Kardashian. You know, from a basketball standpoint, though, that's not really helping your team, but it does draw in fans like Ellen.
He's been very underwhelming in so many ways, mostly being Khloe Kardashian's partner.
Really?
Yes. Are you serious?
But not this year. I think he's been good.
Are they still married?
They're allegedly engaged.
Okay. Now, there's always a Kardashian that's disengaged from someone.
Well, yes, as you know, my recent loss.
Yes, Kim Kardashian getting a divorce from Kanye West.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right. I know there's always one. I have three daughters, you know, and I walk through the house sometimes and that crap is on TV. And I just, you know, I say to my
dad. And you watch it.
They're in their 30s. And I said, you know, why don't you just go over to the stove and just get a frying pan and just put your head down there and fry your brain. It'll fry it like much quicker. It'll be over in like 30 seconds rather than watching this crap all the time.
They are the zeitgeist of our pop culture.
That's true. There is some truth to that. But, I mean, Tristan Thompson, you know, I think it's good that he's been quiet off the court. That's good for Khloe. But I think he's been a little quiet on the court, which is not good for the Celtics.
You know, you see guys in other uniform. When Tristan Thompson was playing for Cleveland, you said, boy, wouldn't he look great in a Celtics uniform?
Yes.
When you saw Teague, you know, wouldn't he look great in a Celtics uniform? Now they're in a Celtics uniform. Why don't they look as great as we imagined that they would be?
And this is something I thought at the time, and this is not me calling, you know, hoops hindsight. When Danny Ainge made those moves, I said, I think they're getting names, not players. I think both of these guys are past their prime.
You give a failing grade to Jeff Teague, and I give him a failing grade too.
Yeah.
I'm giving Thompson an incomplete right now. But I'm not far away from taking my red pen out and giving him his final grade. When the red pen comes out, watch out.
So speaking of grades, Lynchy, what would you grade the two young All-Stars for this team? Jason Tatum's going to start in the All-Star game because Kevin Durant is out with an injury. Jaylen Brown, an All-Star for the first time. I think the 30,000-foot view as a Celtics fan, I know it's been frustrating of late, but it's pretty exciting to have two young All-Stars, two All-Stars under the age of 25. But I do think we've seen maybe during this last stretch, you know, that stretch where they lost 8 of 11 before bouncing back with back-to-back wins, I think you've seen some of the growing pains of those guys sort of getting the reins of the franchise.
No, I think you're right. I think there was a little sense of entitlement to both of them that, you know, they hadn't won anything, but they sort of felt like they were entitled. Okay, I'm a member of the Celtics. I can score. And, you know, I look up, I'm probably going to be up there on the rafters someday. You know, they don't have a ring yet. Neither one of them has a ring. They've played in conference finals, obviously. A lot of times they just fall back into this selfish style of play. They force a three and they don't get back on defense. Last night, what impressed me, Jason Tatum had 31 points. He scored 6 points or 7 points in 40 seconds or something night.
Yeah, six, yeah.
His two best plays were on defense. When he scored that last play, instead of celebrating, he jumped right on the double team with Green on Beal and forced Beal to slip and fall and step out of bounds. And that gave the Celtics a ball. And then on the final shot of the game in front of the Celtics bench, he was part of that double team that forced Beal to take Beal had no good look at all. Almost went in.
I know, it's unbelievable.
But he played great defense without fouling Beal right there. So to me, that was a statement game for Jason Tatum. You know, playing because defense, you don't need skill to play defense. You just have to have a lot of heart and you have to have a lot of unselfishness and you have to put your interests, the team's interest above yours at all time. And that's what he did last night. So I was impressed by that.
You're right about defense, though. I mean, you know, defense takes no skill. It just takes will. A guy like Kemba Walker, some guys are limited by their size. Isaiah Thomas was the same way. Like if you're short and thin like them or me, then you just have no chance against some of these guys. You're just physically overmatched. For a guy like Tatum or a guy like Brown, you know, there's really sort of no excuse. And that's what was disappointing to me about the Dallas loss. Because I would have thought one of those guys would have stepped up and said, I'll take Luka. And that's not what happened. You know, looking at Brown and Tatum, because you've played basketball, coached it, reffed it. What do you see when you see players like that? Because the thing that I've seen is sometimes it's hard for young players to translate their individual growth and success into team success. Why do you think that has been the case for these two guys?
I think it's a product of all these young players now, where they've come up through the AAU ranks. And the only way you get noticed in AAU is by the box score, you know, putting points on it. And it's not a team-oriented culture, AAU. And Leo Papil, who runs the Boston Club, has been a long friend of mine. And I'm always having this argument with him. He said, look, these kids, you know, they need to get college scholarships. They think they're going to get a college scholarship by, averaging 9 points and 10 assists. They'd rather average 19 points and 2 assists. That's how they're going to get noticed. That's how they're going to get the scholarship. So I think that's a big part of it. You know, they've got a good coach who's obviously had a great team in at Butler, who preached ball movement.
Definitely.
And, you know, I know one of Brad's big things is he looks at the box score after the game. And I did a little bit of research.
Here we go.
So
the notebook is coming out.
The notebook is coming out, okay?
I love when Lynchy does research.
In there, now, Brad has said this, and I've always been a proponent of this. 20 or more assists a game increases your chance of winning.
Okay.
In their wins this year, okay, here's the number of his team assists. 23, 21, 27, 35, 19, 22, 21, 25, 26, 28, 16, 28, 21, 30, 26, 26, 24, and last night, 25.
Wow. So like 16 and 9, anything under 20 is like an outlier.
Yeah.
That they actually somehow won the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm looking at their losses here. I got 19, 18, 15, 18, 22, et cetera, et cetera. So they move the ball. And if he can get them to buy in on this thing, look, we dish this ball around, and I know nobody wants to watch any old stuff, but every once in a while, like, stuff comes up with the 86 team with the Celtics,
yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Just watch some of this right
here. Oh, it's unbelievable.
Watch them just pass the basketball. They don't care who touches. They don't care who scores and how many touches everybody has. And I don't want to sound like a cranky old man, but
no.
But moving the ball is impressive, and not many teams do it in the NBA. I mean, I think Utah,
and that's why they have the best record in the league. Yeah. They're great at that.
Utah's good at it. San Antonio's always been good at it.
Golden State.
Really kind of fun to watch.
Totally.
Yeah.
To your point, you know, here's some stats to buttress what you're saying, Lynchy.
Go ahead.
The Celtics are 25th in the NBA in assists per games at 23.
Yeah.
I mean, they are not, you know, really sort of moving the ball the way that they have in the past. And here's another stat that I had. This is sort of 2 games ago before they won the last 2 games. This is a weird stat from NBA.com, really sort of these advanced tracking stats. But the Celtics at that point were tied for the second highest percentage of unassisted field goals in the NBA. And they also were 4th in the NBA in frequency of field goals that came with 7 or more dribbles. Of those shots with 7 or more dribbles, they were 28th in a 30-team league in field goal percentage on those shots, under 40% at 39. And when I see that, I think of Tatum, and he did such a better job of this against the Wizards. You know, he changed speeds, he would attack quickly, but a lot of times what I see with Tatum is he has the mismatch, right? And he knows it. But he catches the ball, he holds it, he sizes up his guy. He sort of does like all this shake and bake dribbling and then tries to go. And the problem with that is, yeah, you have the mismatch and you can beat your guy. But now you've reset the whole offense and you've also let the defense reset. So the other guys, the other 4 guys on defense know our guy's in trouble. Tatum's going to get by him. Tatum wants to score so they can set up the help. So now all of a sudden, instead of just beating your guy off the dribble, which you could do if you went quickly, now you have to dribble through like a brick wall. And I think that's one of the problems I've noticed with Tatum. You know, he gets that mismatch and he wants to kind of reset it and play one-on-one and slow everything down. And that just helps the defense reset itself and set up the help.
And when he's doing all this, I'm watching the shot clock.
As
the shot clock, you know, dwindles and comes down, your chance of getting a good look dwindle as well. And so, you know, he probably puts up a lot more shots, poor choices of shots, because he just dribbles the ball so long. It just doesn't look.
And also, I think, look, he's so great. He can make some of those shots. Shot clock winding down, the sidestep threes, become the master of that. But also, when you're that talented, if you give yourself more space and time and attack, you can get a better shot. You can get all the way to the basket. So I think it's a balancing act. I think we're seeing some growing pains with the young guys as they try and learn the best way to balance their individual talents with success for the team. I think there's also another culprit here when I look at the Celtics being a 500 team. I think it's Danny Ainge. And Danny said this. I'm not sure there's enough help around these young guys, enough guys for them to trust. And when I look at the fact that they got nothing back for Gordon Hayward other than the traded player exception, the TPE, when they could have gotten usable pieces from Indiana. And I look at all the draft picks they've had, and obviously they hit home runs with Tatum and Brown, but a lot of the other picks, the RJ Hunters, the James Youngs, the Gershon Yabusele's, Ante Jicic, you know, the jury's out on Langford and Neesmith. Peyton Pritchard's been good, but they've had a lot of draft picks, yeah. And they really touted having all those picks, that cache of picks, and I'm not sure they cashed in on that cash the way they really should have when you look at their roster.
I couldn't agree more, and I think Danny's the first to admit it as well.
What would you like to see Danny do here at the trade deadline? Because now there's a lot of talk that, again, they have this traded player exception, and without getting too esoteric or going too in the weeds, it's $28.5 million. It's the largest in NBA history, but they can't, you know, use it all this year without sending salary back. So now they're sort of saying they think maybe they're more likely to use it in the offseason when they can take a bigger swing on somebody like Atlanta's John Collins. But what would you like to see Danny Ainge do to help this team between now and March 25th, the trade deadline?
I want a big guy. I think if you get all the four guys back and healthy, I don't think you need an offensive guy. I think
really, you do. You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think you need a guy that's just going to get in the middle there and just – stop a guy like Beal that came down the lane last night every time, uncontested, and just nobody was there. I mean, you just bang him once in a while when he comes down the lane because he had no fear. He was fearless and said, who's going to stop me? And every once in a while when someone came off him, he just kicked it in the corner to Westbrook and bang, there was a three-point shot. And so that's what I want to see. I just want to see a big guy.
Do you think Robert Williams can be that guy, or do you think that's too big of a gamble?
I do. And, he's very athletic.
Oh, my God. He's unbelievable.
He's an unbelievable athlete. So you got to if he doesn't get a big guy, you got to make your choice, Tice or Williams, and I'm leaning towards Williams a lot.
No, I mean he's a great rim. I think that's one reason maybe they wouldn't get the center because look, they've had this two center starting lineup for a lot of the year with Thompson and Tice. I think that's one of the stronger positions on the team, even though you're totally right about needing more rebounding and rim protection. But I think it might be there internally. I think they need another wing player who can create his own shot off the bench. Because the bench scoring's not there, and they don't have those bench guys. None of them can create their own offense.
I agree. They've been a big disappointment off the bench. Grant Williams is coming off there. I thought he'd be a little bit more of a prolific scorer. Teague, we've already talked about. Ogilvy is a smart player.
Yeah.
Good defensive player. But do you want the ball in his hands?
No.
So
Ogilvy plays Lynchy to me like you remember table hockey?
Yeah.
He plays offense like he's a table hockey player and he's just in a groove and he can only go between one part like the corner of the 3-point line out to the bend. And that's the only place he can go. He plays like that to me.
You're right. That's a good point. So prior number one, big man. Prior number two, scoring off the bench. Because I have no confidence in anybody off that bench that can come in and fill a void and score 12 points, in a game.
Would you give up a first round? Would you be willing to give up like a first round pick in the coming draft to try and get one of those guys? Or do you just sort of say, okay, we're just going to make a smaller investment or we'll roll the dice with the guys we have and hope for the best because deep down we feel like we're not a championship team this year?
I think that's the latter.
Okay.
I don't see them getting out of the East. Past Philadelphia or Brooklyn, and maybe even Milwaukee. I don't know. It's hard to say. So I still think we're in a COVID area here. We don't know if any more games are going to get postponed or if the playoffs are going to get dragged out. But I don't think they're a contender this year. I would save the number one pick and then next year, all in, make a run at an NBA championship next year. I just don't think they have it this year.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there with the Celtics. I mean, I think that's about as definitive as it gets from Lynchy. And let's see if they can finish strong before the All-Star break. I want to we go from finishing strong to starting out optimistically with the Red Sox. I want to get your opinion here on the Red Sox. We had Sam Kennedy on the podcast, and it seems like they are very bullish on their team this year coming off the last place finish. I mentioned to Sam that it's interesting with the Red Sox. They're in this sort of boom or bust cycle. They finished last year. They were brutal. Are you optimistic about this Red Sox team, or do you think it's going to be more of what we saw last year?
I have zero optimism for this team right now. That is my level of optimism. 0.0, as Dean Wormer said to many of the crew of Delta House on Animal House.
Ellen, not alive for that movie.
This is...
was not, but have seen it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, kind of a... kind of a guy's movie. Yeah, I don't think that...
I'm a guy's guy,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there were chick flicks and there were guy movies, you know. So I have zero confidence in this team. They finished in last place with some pretty good people on their roster back in 2012 and in the following years when they finished in last place. They finished in last place last year because they didn't have the talent that could match up.
But can you believe that vaunted homegrown outfield of Mookie and Wright, JBJ in center, and Andrew Benintendi in left? 2 years after you win a World Series, they're probably all going to be gone. That's insane.
I thought the exact same thing last night. I think about that. They were anointed as maybe the best defensive outfield, not only in Red Sox, but maybe of all time. And every place they went, somebody was making a spectacular play. Lock them up, get them secured, have them be part of the Red Sox, you know, core going forward. It's hard to believe they're all gone right now. But this is a team that is going to finish probably in last place in the American League East. You know, it wasn't that long ago. You're looking at the lineup. Okay, who's going to start opening day? You're going to give the ball to Sale? You're going to give it to Price? You're going to give it to Porcello? I mean, who are you gonna, Nathan Eovaldi's going to get it this year,
maybe,
right?
Maybe Eduardo Rodriguez coming back from myocarditis.
Yeah, you don't know.
COVID, hopefully. He was really good. I mean, he won 19 games the last year he was able to pitch. He wasn't able to pitch at all last year because of COVID. You just keep that in mind, people. It's not just older folks who get COVID.
Yep, he was. And right now, he's slated as their sixth starter in spring training.
Yeah. They have to be careful with him the heart stuff.
You have to because you don't know. You know, I mean, Franchi Cordero, I keep thinking of Franchi Fuqua every time
Really? I keep thinking of Massachusetts native Jeff Francoeur, who they would call Frenchie. That was his nickname.
There used to be a running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers who was very, very flamboyant. Frenchie Fuqua.
Oh, wow.
So this is almost like Alex Verdugo last year when he had the injury after the trade.
Oh, you're right.
So now they make a trade. They send Benintendi for Franchi Cordero, and he's got COVID.
Yeah, he's stuck in the Dominican Republic with COVID. My fear on Franchi Cordero is that he might be the left-handed Willie Mopena. Remember Willie Mopena, who was one of the nicest guys? But, I mean, he could hit the ball to the moon.
Yeah.
And they traded Bronson Arroyo, Theo did, to Cincinnati for Willie Mopena. He was going to be kind of like, you know, Manny Ramirez light if they could tap into his potential. They could never tap into his potential.
It was going to be Willie Mays Akins. That's who he was going to be. Just like the Kansas City Royals.
Yeah.
That's who he was going to be.
So I it's interesting because I'll be honest. I think I'm a little more optimistic than you are about the Red Sox. I don't think they'll finish in last. I think they might be headed for another third place finish. Their division's tough. I mean, Toronto went out and added guys. They added George Springer. The Rays were in the World Series last year. The Yankees, I think, are always a highly competitive team under Brian Cashman. So there's quite the mountain to climb for the Red Sox. But Lynchy, I think it all comes down to the pitching. You go to last year with the Red Sox, they had the worst earned run average in the history of the franchise, 5.58 ERA, the highest mark in franchise history. Also, they used an MLB high 16 starters last year. So starting pitching, you know, it's sort of like presidents and the economy. Right? You know, it's the economy, stupid. What do you want to run on? It's the economy, stupid. Well, with the baseball team, it's the starting pitching, stupid. No matter how many of these openers, bulk starters, whatever we're calling these guys, you need to have pitching or you're toast.
As my dad used to say, there's a fist fight at the bat rack, Mike. You know, everybody wants to get up and hit against Red Sox pitching. Everyone's at the back. Put me up. I want to hit against these guys. Fist fight at the bat rack. And that's what it was last year. I don't see a heck of a lot of improvement this year. Is Eovaldi going to be healthy? I mean, ever since they gave him that $64 or $68 million deal after the World Series, when is Chris Sale going to throw again?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at a June-July timeline for Sale coming off of Tommy John.
So that'll be how many years since he hasn't really pitched? 3 years, basically, almost?
Two or three. I mean, it's been a while. I mean, he should have had the Tommy John surgery after the 19 season. He really should have had it November, December of 19, because then he'd already be back.
You think about they thought nothing about it. And John Henry's big thing was you don't give multi-year contracts to left-hand pitchers.
Over 30. Don't trust anybody over 30.
Exactly. and you know, what do? They give him all this money. And I'm thinking about this new group that's got Billy Bean in it that's going to join the Fenway Sports Group.
Oh, it's a Red Ball.
I can't remember what it is. Okay. But are they moving away from their baseball product for their other business interests? And this really disturbs me that all these investments are being made in everything but the baseball team.
So it was Redbird Capital.
Okay. That's
it,
yep.
And they were nearing a deal for more than 10% of the Fenway Sports Group for approximately $750 million, which would make the group valued at $7
billion. Wow. $7 billion.
Wow.
And you're looking at Mookie Betts going to the Dodgers and signing after the trade, a big deal. Why couldn't that happen here?
Well, I'll say this. In defense of the Red Sox, and you won't hear me say that phrase often, but in defense of the Red Sox, I think the Mookie Betts thing was a little bit like Tom Brady in that I think he was ready to move on. I think Mookie's been very calculated and very careful to talk about his Red Sox days, but I just don't think at the end of the day that the Boston baseball experience and living his life in the fishbowl of being the face of the Red Sox was for him.
Yeah, he's a little bit of an introvert. He's a really nice guy.
Oh, great guy.
Beyond belief guy, great family guy. And I remember the American League Championship Series, Mike Cole and I were standing outside our hotel, the Hilton, ready to do our 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And here comes three women and a guy walking down the street licking ice cream cones. And it's Mookie Betts with his fiance, at the time girlfriend. I think his mom might have been with him and his sister. And, hey, Mook, what's going on? Nah, just getting a little ice cream, you know. And they were playing the next day for the right to go to the World Series. And he just said, hey, have a good night, and just kept walking down the street. And, you know, next day, they win the American League Championship.
Wow, yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah, yeah, I mean, he just always seemed like a pretty normal guy, but also someone who maybe prized his privacy a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to do that here in Boston.
But he's in Los Angeles now.
Yeah, but here's the thing. It's the same thing. And David Wells has said this about playing in New York. When you're in one of those media markets where they have other celebrities, like here, our celebrities are the athletes, sportscasters like yourself, because people are so invested in sports. But when you're in New York or LA, it's like the celebrities are actual celebrities. So it's a weird thing. Like, you can sort of blend in. Like, I remember David Wells saying that. David Wells loved playing in New York. He loved the energy and he loved everything about it. He hated playing here with the Red Sox because he said that it was more scrutiny than New York. Again, it was like living in a fishbowl. He felt like he couldn't go to dinner. People are coming up to him. Way more people knew David Wells here than even in New York.
Yeah, that's a good point. A good point. You sort of you blend in New York and Los Angeles. Yeah. Here, you stand out.
Yeah.
You know, and none more so than the manager. I think the manager falls under more scrutiny than the governor. Although probably not in the last 12 months or so.
Well, you know, the governor, you have a direct line to the governor.
I know you
don't live in Swampscott anymore, but yeah, Swampscott boy, you have a direct line.
I have a direct line. My mother walks by his house every day and, you know, talks to, you know, his wife if she's out there, and all the state troopers that are around the house all the time. So, I can slide something in if you need it. Let me know after the show.
Now, did Mrs. Lynch go down there and say and ask him, Charlie, when am I going to be able to get my vaccine? I can't get an appointment.
You know, he called me up the day after my father died in 2018, and it said no caller ID, and I said, hello, hey Mike, it's Charlie Baker, how you doing? I said, hey Charlie. He said, you got a moment? I said, sure. He says, I'm really sorry about your dad. So when he first moved to Swampscott, he lived on Banks Road, which is where my parents live, and Banks doesn't mean anything money, but there's railroad tracks behind my house, and trust me. And so he said, I'm really sorry, boy, I love, you know, your dad. He would sit in the stands as my father's grandsons, my nephews, played with Charlie's boys. They played football, basketball, lacrosse. He said he would sit there and, you know, and he'd say, boy, if they don't take out number 22 by halftime, this game's over. You better watch out. And sure enough, it happened. And I know a lot about sports, but he saw things I never saw. He goes, and then he concludes it this way. He says, you know, I hope he rests in peace. He's one of the greatest guys I've ever, but I will never, ever forgive him for one event. He and I made it to the finals of the Swampscott Spelling Bee, Charlie Baker against Dick Lynch. And he says, he not only beat me, he kicked my rear end all over the place. He goes, and I hate to, I'm a Harvard guy like you. I hated losing to a BU guy like your father.
That's a great story.
That's a fantastic story.
Oh, that is amazing. That is amazing. Oh, wow. That is so cool. Yeah.
And I asked somebody after, I said, is that true? He goes, oh, yeah. He says, he just wiped them off the planet. You know, it was hysterical.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. No, I mean, that is a fantastic story. And yeah, you mentioned the governor is a big sports fan. Actually, you know, I was going to ask you this, but now I want to, because we brought up the governor. You know, starting March 22nd, you can have fans back in the stands here. What do you think that will mean for Boston sports and for the teams and just for the region?
I think it's a little bit of energy for the players. You know, it's really hard. I'm back to Allen Iverson again. Nobody likes practice, but a lot of the games feel like practice. I think Belichick said that one time when they asked him after the first, second game, what's it like? He just went, practice. Practice. And I couldn't understand what we were saying. But I think I'll add a little bit of energy. Now, I mean, 2,500 people, you know, at a hockey or basketball game is better than zero. I mean, there will be some natural noise. There will be some booing of the officials. There will probably be some booing of the team as well. But I think it'll add a little energy, I think. I think the players will like it. We saw the first sign of it Sunday in a preseason game when the Red Sox played over at the Hammond Stadium, the Twins ballpark. I think it's a good thing. New York did it last week.
Yeah.
And now, Massachusetts is doing it. And, you know, if things keep going the way they are progressing, you know, we'll increase that to a higher percentage.
And just speaking of fans, too, because we were talking about the Red Sox, you know, you have really encyclopedic knowledge of the Boston sports scene, and you've been around for a long time. I mentioned this to Sam Kennedy when he was on the podcast. I can't remember there being this level of disinterest and apathy, just general apathy in the Red Sox. Can you remember the last time it was like this?
Yeah, I can. I can tell you what year it was. It was 1966. And at the time, the American League was no divisions. It was a 10-team American League. And from like 1960 through 66, the Red Sox finished either 9th or 10th. And there was nothing to look forward to. The only thing they had going for them is they had some stars. They had Carl Yastrzemski. They had Tony Conigliaro. They had Dick Raddatz. I think Rico Petrocelli might have been on the team then. But it was just, okay. And you could go to Fenway Park. And we always, what you did was you banged the seat because nobody was sitting next to you. We want a hit. We want a hit. And you could sit wherever you wanted because they probably averaged, 10,000 people per game. There just wasn't any interest. And then 67 happened, the impossible dream. And that changed everything. And every season was filled with optimism and excitement and hope from 67 forward. Even some of the bad years when, Butch Hobson was managing the team, there still was hope. I mean, you had guys like Roger Clemens on the team, and Rich Gedman, and you had players. But this was 66. I think I'm dating myself. Now, in 66, I was 13 years old. So I had finished playing Little League. I was probably playing Babe Ruth.
Good year.
Yeah. 66? Is that Ellen? Great.
Good year. Yeah. Yeah,
sure. Nice.
Yeah.
There we go.
Maybe
beautiful.
You're remembering a previous lifetime, Ellen.
So, but yeah, I think anybody of my generation that you ask will say that because I think it's hard to find a year, even after those bad years. There were some great players on some of the Red Sox teams where there was this much apathy, I think, about going into the season.
I mean, to me, and I don't know how you feel about it, to me, there's no greater indictment for an organization when fans, not only are they disappointed by the team, but they don't even care.
I mean, I would pick up the paper last summer. I'm still one of the guys that still gets the paper, and I'd say, so-and-so pitching for the Red Sox today. Now, I've been in this business for a long time, and I said, who? Have I ever heard of this guy? And then I start looking for it. I say, oh, yeah, he's the guy that, was in AA a couple of years ago. But, it's not like picking up, okay, it's Sale. Oh, it's Price. Oh, it's Porcello. It's Rodriguez going today. Now it's like Redford and Newman and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Who are these guys? Who are these guys?
These are all pop culture references that Ellen gets.
Yes.
I just want to piggyback on that because this is really interesting what you're saying. Do you think that is – look, they brought in Chaim Bloom. I have a lot of respect for him. He's sort of done it the Tampa Bay Rays way. But the Rays are one of the teams, I think, at the vanguard, Mike, of this new baseball philosophy, which is sort of that – building a baseball team and getting the most out of players, it's almost like they're mathematical equations to be solved. And it's less about the players and their personality. Do you think that's ultimately a negative for baseball, just what you were talking about, where it's sort of all these interchangeable parts and you're cycling through all these players because it's not really about the players. They feel like it's more about the philosophy.
Are there more Chaim Blooms making decisions than there are? Are there more than one Chaim Blooms?
Oh, totally. I mean, that is now the prevailing, nature. Your fellow Ivy Leaguers have taken over baseball. And I've said this
the
for
nerds.
Well, I'm a nerd, so I'm going to say. Those highly educated people have taken over baseball, and they have made it more efficient. But more efficient is not necessarily more entertaining. And ultimately, at the end of the day, what their product is, it's entertainment.
Well, this is not an entertaining team. Their star level is horrendous. Xander Bogaerts is the face of the Boston Red Sox. And who's after that? Rafael Devers? Christian Vasquez? Michael Chavez?
Verdugo?
Alex Verdugo? No.
Actually, you know who the face of the Red Sox is? It's Alex Cora. That's why he's back.
You're probably right.
I mean, there used to be these like cult role players, and now the Red Sox don't even have sort of transcendent star. I put a poll up on Twitter and WCVB NFL.com a while ago, like, who's the face of Boston sports now that Brady is gone? And Xander Bogaerts was the guy I elected for the Red Sox, and he finished dead last.
Who were the other three?
It was like Patrice Bergeron, Jason Tatum, I think Julian Edelman was one.
Okay.
And it was and Bogaerts finished like dead last. I had more people writing in saying you should have David Pastrnak, and I sort of said, okay, I see your point, but yes. I'm going with Bergeron here. But more people were saying no as Pastrnak than were saying like, oh, what about baseball and Xander Bogaerts? I want to let you go here, but I want to ask you this because of your relationship with Bill Belichick, and also, you know, the fact that you played football at such a high level and you played the quarterback position. What do you see the Patriots doing at quarterback? And give me the Mike Lynch ideal scenario for a quarterback for the Patriots in 2021.
I'd like them to get Mac Jones out of Alabama. I love him. I think he's played in big games. I think that he's, and everyone says, well, you never want to get an Alabama quarterback. They're just part of the system. Their talent is so good. And then, you know, the talent disparity is so big. I don't believe that in the Southeastern Conference. And I think there's a couple, you know, Jalen Hurts is now going to be successful.
Yeah, with Philadelphia.
Tua is going to be successful in Miami. He was an Alabama quarterback. And I think Jones is going to be very successful.
Also, let me just name a couple of Alabama quarterbacks in the past that have been successful. Have you heard of Joe Namath or Kenny Stabler?
Pretty. Yeah, I've heard of him a little bit. Yeah. Have you ever heard of Bart Starr?
Yeah, Bart. There's another one, Bart Starr. Yes.
That would be my number one choice. Number two, Marcus Mariota. Very interesting.
You're preaching
very
to the choir.
Interesting project, I think he would be. I think he's a smart guy, a versatile guy. He might not have been in the right situation, obviously, down there. I look at Ryan Tannehill, who was in Miami and then just went to Tennessee and flourished. Could Marcus Mariota be like Ryan Tannehill, come to Boston with Bill Belichick, with Josh McDaniels, and be a high-performing quarterback to bring the Patriots back into contention?
Yeah, I love what you're saying, and I agree in that Ryan Tannehill theory too. And the irony of it is that Ryan Tannehill's emergence displaced Marcus Mariota in Tennessee.
Yeah, I know.
And so maybe he can come here, and I think he can do a lot of the same things Cam Newton can do, but he can do them better. And I also think that people write off sort of the retread recycled quarterback, but let me give you a retread recycled quarterback that another genius coach found. And I'm going to give you his first 2 years in the NFL with his initial team, and I'll see if you can figure out who this guy is. His record, 3-16, completion percentage, 53.3%, TDs, 11, interceptions, 21, quarterback rating, 63.1, sacks, he took 68, and yet another great all-time coach decided to acquire this guy for a second-round pick and a fourth-round pick. He had a pretty good career.
Steve Young?
Bingo. Steve Young. Nobody would have predicted at that time that Steve Young would have done what he did with the 49ers. He was awful with the Buccaneers, so bad that the Buccaneers got the first pick to draft Vinny Testaverde, which is why they traded him. So, look, I understand that's the outlier. There's not a ton of Steve Youngs out there, or even Rich Gannons, these guys that are sort of retreads and that you on the second try or the third try, they're good. But for me, that's the best place for the Patriots to shop to get back to the playoffs. You need a Mariota, a Mitchell Trubisky, a Sam Darnold, and maybe if you can pair that with the draft pick, because the bust rate on these quarterbacks in the draft is high. Field Yates, our friend Field Yates, had this tweet recently. From 2009 to 2016, all the quarterbacks drafted in the first round are no longer with their original team.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Does not surprise me. And look at the Jared Goff and Carson Wentz. They go 2 and 3.
Goff was the number one overall pick.
Okay, they went 1 and 2 then.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1 and 2. And now they're both gone from their original teams, from the Rams and from the Eagles. Belichick always had a saying when I talked to him. I said, this guy looks unbelievable. And I hope this doesn't come out the wrong way with violence and everything else. He would say, let's see how he is when the real bullets start flying. That was his phrase.
Yeah.
He would say all the time. And I'd say, really? He goes, yeah, you watch. You know,
that sounds like Bill. It's like kind of like dismissive, like, eh, I don't think so, Mike.
Just like that. And I'd come in like, you know, after an exhibition game on Monday, and I'd say, Chris Gasperi went, did I tell you?
Wow. That's interesting. Well, as always, we really enjoy tapping into your sports brain here. The stories are great. The insight is great, Mike. It's always great to have you back here at Channel 5, the house that Mike Lynch built. So thanks for joining us here on the Take 5 podcast.
By the way, Ellen is a star. by the way.
Oh, I know it.
This podcast. I mean, you know, you're Johnny Carson. She's, you know, Ed McMahon, or you know, she.
I think I'm Ed McMahon, and she's Johnny
say,
Carson.
That's what I was going to say. She
we'll
is a
keep
star.
This in.
But again, but again, I'd say maybe that's your sixth pop culture reference that Ellen has no idea. Like she's like Johnny Carson. Like she probably is like Jay Leno created the Tonight Show.
I got to get more up to date. I mean, you know, my kids tell me this all the time. Dad, what are you talking about? Dad, what are you talking?
Oh no! First of all, Lynchy, don't feel bad because I make references to Ellen that she doesn't get. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things. It's just, I mean, it's just what your frame of reference is. And she has a young person's frame of reference and we don't.
You know, and I know we want to wrap this up. But yeah. One of my daughters, I think, or someone on another podcast was talking about Tiger Woods being one of the more recognizable figures around the world, like Michael Jordan. And I said, take Michael Jordan, take Tiger Woods, multiply them by 10 million. And that's the impact Muhammad Ali had on planet Earth in terms of being an athlete, being of someone speaking out for social injustice, standing out for what was right. HBO has a great documentary called What's My Name. If you want to see an impact that somebody had on people on the planet, Muhammad Ali is the guy. You should really go see it. It's pretty good.
Well, Muhammad Ali said, you know, I am the greatest. Mike Lynch is the greatest. We really enjoyed having you here on the podcast, Mike. We'll talk to you soon.
Good. Thank you very much. Glad to be here, and call me anytime.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it, as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.